Brighton, and together with Mark Fishman, we're leading the committee on management of university intellectual property. This is a committee that was convened to take a look at how well we are doing in moving the results of research into the hands of those who can develop and commercialize and bring benefit to society from the considerable investments that government, corporations, and foundations are making in fundamental research. We've already had two meetings of our committee, and those who have provided sponsorship for our committee's work encouraged us to have a more public meeting, and these 2 days represent a fulfillment of that commitment, and we're very privileged to have some really outstanding contributors to our panel. We have important sessions both today and tomorrow, and for the committee members, we will have an opportunity both days to meet and begin reflecting on what we're learning. The time frame for our report from this committee is that we hope to have a substantive draft with recommendations and conclusions that would be prepared for our February meeting, and we'll have ample time as a committee to debate and consider all of those issues that will come forward. The format for our meetings today and tomorrow will be somewhat informal compared to many public meetings where outstanding presenters are present. I hope the panelists will understand that there may well be questions, and our moderators will have to accommodate. This panel is going to be led by one of our great committee members, Leslie Cohen, who's professor of economics and management at Duke University, and I'm going to leave it to him to introduce the panelists. I would encourage all who are here to feel free to interject, to ask good questions. Those on our committee are going to be listening carefully and also interjecting and putting forward questions. We do hope that this will be interactive. We'll have opportunities at breaks and at other times to interact informally. It's not such a large room or large group that we can't have something akin to a discussion, though we do want our panelists to be able to communicate their views and observations of the issues that surround intellectual property that's been created by universities. There are elements of controversy in this, and I appreciate that, and we'll look forward to a stimulating couple of days. And for those who are working with me and Mark on this committee, we need to be very sensitive to what people are saying and try to come to conclusions and hopefully some recommendations that will be rewarding to the community of researchers and those who use what we do. So with that, I introduce Wesley Cohen and turn the program over to him. Thanks very much, Wes, for leading.
Thank you very much, Mark. First, I want to outline the objective for today's panel, then talk a little bit about process, and then provide a brief introduction to the panelists. That'll just be one-liners. The detailed bios are in the conference workshop literature. So the theme of the first panel is to consider the organization and evaluation of the technology transfer function within institutions, predominantly, though not exclusively, universities. And by technology transfer, we construe this broadly, thinking about, you know, movement of discoveries, inventions from public research into the commercial and market spheres. So the objective of this particular panel is to try to consider how well this function, if you will, is being met, being satisfied by the status quo. If there are problems, if there are challenges, why is that? And to also even pose some alternatives to think about that will be more than just incremental changes on the current state of affairs. Regarding the process, how this panel is going to run, a number of the panelists will provide, though not all, will provide just brief introductory remarks. We're going to try to keep those very brief, no more than 3 minutes. At that point, we're going to move through a series of questions. In your literature, there are questions that are identified. We have since sort of amended those and revised and switched order a little bit, and so these questions will be addressed flexibly. But the point is we really want to instigate a dialogue among the panelists and subsequently between the panelists and the audience members as well. So this is not your basic stand and deliver format. It's really designed to be much more interactive. And with that, let me just provide the very brief introductions to the members of our panel in really random order as they appear list here. Martin Kenney, to my left, is a professor in the Department of Human and Community Development at the University of California, Davis. Rich Helfridge, toward but not quite at the end, is a partner in Alameda Advisors, also in California. We have Dana Bostrom, who's heads up the Tech Transfer Office at Portland State University. It is also very closely with the Association of University Technology Managers. We also have Christina Johnson, who is the Provost and Senior Vice President for Academic Affairs at Johns Hopkins University. And we finally have Tony Hay, who is the Corporate Vice President of the External Research Division of Microsoft Research. And each of these panelists will certainly also convey a sense of their own experience and background in the course of making their remarks. Their current positions do not necessarily reflect, as you might imagine, their full range of experience, which is just extraordinarily rich. So with that, I'd like to start off with the initial remarks. And why don't we do this? Why don't we just move down, if this is okay, down the table, starting with Martin, going to Dana. And not everyone here wants to proceed. Martin, you thought that, you know, you will chime in a little bit later. And I see Christina. If I recall, you had a minute or two that you introductory remark that you wanted to offer.
Thanks, Wes. I'm just going to say a little bit about my background to put into context maybe some of my remarks. So I started out as a student at Stanford 30 years ago when Niels Reimer, if anybody knows Niels, was one person in a secretary in a trailer behind the freshman dorm of Brainerd with a little invention, and since then have tried to translate research into practice. So I might comment on some of those experiences, which I would entitle the good, the bad, the ugly.
Great. And Tony,
okay,
please.
Yes. Well, I was an academic for 30 years. I started as a physicist and then moved into electronics and computer science. I became head of the department there and was responsible for incubating various spin-outs there, and as dean of engineering later on, I was on Southampton's University's innovation company, which looked at how we did spin outs. And we did everything wrong initially, and I was responsible for firing our TTO, all right, and recruiting a new one, which has been very successful. So I have some experience from the university side, and now I'm in Microsoft. I negotiate with TTOs, and we had an interesting negotiation with Dana. So I see things from both sides.
Great. Very good. Rich, if you might, please.
Yes. My view is going to be quite different. I've actually not been on the academic side. I've been a serial entrepreneur, a corporate executive in a public company. I've been a corporate venture capitalist. I've been an independent standalone venture capitalist with a firm. And I've been a venture capitalist with a firm outside the United States. And I have recently been unable to raise a new fund due to this tough financial crisis. So now I'm actually helping governments do economic development from technology commercialization. And I feel that the real metric for technology commercialization is the number of jobs you create, the number of tax revenues your spin-out companies or tech licenses create in your country. And we have to really look at the United, and by the way, a lot of the clients I'm lining up are outside, are governments outside the United States, and they seem to understand that the world is in an economic war. And if we're going to win in the United States, we have to do better at taking our technology, which these days is mostly in universities. The corporations aren't doing as much R&D. And General Electric is spending less than 2% of their revenue on R&D these days, when they used to spend over 10, but now it's under 2. And so the universities in the world are doing all the research, and it's not just the United States, but we have to do a much better job of getting that research into products that generate revenue and jobs and taxes so we can fix our U.S. economy. And I've been talking with a lot of our congresspeople. We're getting pretty good support. I think we're going to see a lot of changes in the next few years, and hopefully we can talk about ways we can all make that work and maybe create some legislation that helps.
Thank you very much, Rick. Dana, please.
Hi. I am very pleased to join you today. I have a different perspectives from the three places I've been. I've been at a very, very large university, $1 billion of external research money, to $500 million. Berkeley would say they're still pretty large, and now $40 million. So, and we've had very different structures at our offices. When I joined Portland State, I was offered the title of Director of Technology Commercialization. I said, no, thank you. The really what I think universities are measured on in terms of what we do on a daily basis are the number of relationships that we need to establish. And so I told them that I wanted to be innovation and industry alliances. I agree with Richard that certainly our companies that we license to need to be judged on the jobs that they create, but that is really our job of establishing the right relationships in order to get our innovation to the right people in that way. So I'm very eager to look at what are the right organizational structures for each university that's involved. We in my field shun the terms best practices because essentially every university is different, and the three universities I've been at, I've seen different opportunities and challenges depending a great deal on kind of where they are geographically and where if they're kind of the king of the university in their area or whether they're, you know, one of the less dominant ones. So
great. Good. Thank you very much, David. That's great. So the first question that we're going to lead off with speaks to the issue of, well, what are technology transfer offices and universities more broadly, why are they doing what they're doing? And in particular, and I address this to Christina initially, and then other panelists, feel free to join in. To what extent do you think a principal tech transfer office mission is and should be the earning of revenue for the institution? So, you know, is it for the money? Why don't we start there?
Thank you for that softball, Wes. I've been a professor, a dean, and now a provost, so at a different ways along the food chain. I'm not sure if it's up or down the food chain where I've arrived. You know, there are different expectations. I think that to echo a little bit what Dana said and Richard, certainly in this economic climate, we have to be cognizant that the tech transfer offices should not lose a lot of money. But I certainly think that I often say that tech transfer offices are to scientists and engineers like the libraries are to humanists, social scientists. In other words, I think they're a necessary component of the university, and I think they do three things. One is that they serve the faculty, and that's the first criteria in my view. And the need to do that by building relationships, making connections, being efficient and effective and responsive. I think the second thing is to create jobs and innovation. I think that's what Richard said, in the area, so we pay taxes, and I think a lot of the states are going to be looking at that. And then I think the third thing is it can be measured in terms of those relationships, how they develop contracts. So I would say to Tony that we would be as happy to have you license technology from the university as we would to have you continue to fund Alex and others that are there, because that brings in revenue. And so to have that kind of perspective, I think it's important to understand what tech transfer means to all the different constituents. So I don't think it can be just a bottom line. However, having said that, and I don't know if Ken Porter is here. Ken, are you here? When he comes here. So Ken Porter was a TTO at the University of Colorado and took over that office about the time I left to go to Duke to be Dean of Engineering there. And he really instituted a very efficient, very effective, very measurement-oriented results. Now he's, I think he's head of tech transfer at UT Arlington. And it was very impressive what he did. And so I think that he was quite a good model for the kind of service and value add that he brought to the university.
Sure.
Provost. Yeah, Provost funds it. Provost and also the deans of the various schools that contribute to tech transfer. It's about break even. Well, I would say that it is funded centrally. Centrally meaning both at the university central as well as at the individual units. And if you take that funding that comes in and then you look at the funding that comes in from the outside, they are about break even. But there isn't a one, you know, there's not a one-to-one relationship between each dollar. It just happens that they... Do you really want to know how our library earns the revenue? It's awesome. Lattes. I am not kidding you. It is true. I swear. Lattes. And we've had a dip in the latte purchasing lately because of the economy. This is no joke. It is sort of funny.
Are we going off the
reservation? But this is... But I think... University finance is an interesting thing, and we could go into that, but maybe we could take up this question later.
Yeah, a little later.
But I think it's a good point. I think it's a good point.
Yes, Tony, please.
Okay. I think, in my experience, that it is about relations and trust, and my engineers and 200 faculty, when they saw that the technology transfer office was merely a burden and an overhead that they had to pay for, was not very successful. What we managed to do in creating a new one was create an office which had their trust. They could see it delivered some value, and it actually could generate some revenue. It wasn't just an overhead. And I think that's what you have to get. You have to get the trust of the faculty that they will go to the office, and unless you do that, it's bound to fail. The reason why we closed the first one was because they'd alienated every single one of my faculty, and that's not a very good thing to do.
Let me ask, what the image we're getting is that, well, yeah, earning revenue is certainly on the list, but it's much more complicated, and there are other objectives. But is an objective, is the pressure for earning revenue, and not just earning revenue, but perhaps coming up with the big hit to really generate substantial revenue, has that waned? Has that intensified over the past, say, 5 to 10 years?
From the outside, I would say it certainly seems to have intensified. I mean, I haven't been on the inside, but I've been actually in negotiations with tech transfer offices at several universities. It seems to me they're certainly looking for the big money these days, and maybe I don't know what's happening to university budgets, but maybe there's some problem there.
My experience from talking with my colleagues is that we have more use of what I would say kind of hitting singles or doubles consistently.
That's
right. Don't go for the home run every time. But a number of folks in my field will say they try to maximize the number of active licenses, meaning relationships that universities have with our licensees. And you know, that's certainly not true for every university. Right, but in many ways, we're burdened by the intellectual property policies that we have at our university. universities, right? Because those are set up to maximize the resources back to the individual inventors or developers on a particular case. And if you looked instead at, say, like a mutual fund type of approach, then you might be able to look more broadly across all the revenue that a university may create and how it might distribute it.
Yeah, and I think one of the revenue generators that I've seen that work well in some private university is they focus on let's say, alumni that are generating the licenses and are very well treated, and then later on when they're successful are become huge donors back to the university. And I think that's a very important aspect of how you measure revenues is
sure.
Alumni donations.
I understand. Mark?
So since you're tech transfer offices, and we're experiencing this now at Davis, when the inventor has a very good invention and asks you to return it to the inventor free of charge so that they can go out and commercialize it, are you willing to do that? And what percentage of your best licenses you're not taking the license and you're, because you want to transfer, you're just returning it to the inventor?
Well, Portland State, of course, I'm the first full-time person, so we don't have a lot of experience. I think I've had two people who've requested waivers, and in both of those situations, we released them with the expectation that at some point we'll get our patent expenses that we've paid back, and that's it. And one of them, I don't think actually will ever go anywhere, and the other one, I'm very hopeful that it will go somewhere, but we will see. I think the broader point is if you look at Canada, right? Canada has this option at some universities where the developer owns versus the university owns. If the developer owns, then they pay a portion of that revenue back to the university. My experience with that model is that developers become very lost and confused and don't know that they should or could work with attorneys, are unwilling to sign the kinds of agreements that universities routinely sign regarding intellectual property transfer. So my experience is that kind of the developer owns model has not been as successful as perhaps some might like, at least
so,
in Canada.
So I just, Cambridge University
right.
has had inventor ownership for a very long time. It's just recently changed. It's probably the most successful tech transfer university outside the United States. So I think we have to be really quite careful with those kinds of claims because we've seen, and there's now more and more research in Europe showing that actually in inventor ownership, did a great deal of patenting with firms, which was tech transfer.
Right.
So I think we need to be quite careful on our claims here about inventor ownership.
I agree, and I think the other thing you have to look at is the cultural differences between the U.S. and Canada and the U.K. and those kinds of things. Bob Miller, who I worked with at the University of Washington, came from Canada, would say when you see private-public partnerships in Canada, everyone was very excited, thought this was the best way to maximize resources. In the U.S., when we see that, people say, who's on the take? Right, so we have different cultural environments that govern that, and I think the UK may be part of that as well. The UNICO, which is the University Companies Association, came out with a report today suggesting new metrics that universities ought to use to govern the technology transfer.
If I can interject and follow on with a question that bears just on that. One of the issues, as we all know from whatever organizations, institutions, firms we work for, when there are performance measures, that's what we work to, okay? It's just natural. So the question is both the kinds of measures that come, originate centrally from the Association of University Technology Managers with data on licensing revenue and so on, and then surely universities have their own internal measures as well, and so how do those measures? Money is a pretty easy thing to measure, right? That's really where some of the rubber meets the road here. And to what extent do those performance measures, as both nationally available and as institutionally available, notwithstanding reasonable expectations of what you should be doing for, but to what extent do those measures drive a lot of the behaviors and performance of the tech transfer offices? Dana?
Right. So one of the problems that Autumn has seen with its annual licensing activity survey is that it started 20 years ago as an internal tool for offices to use in this very emerging field to understand what other parties are doing. Soon others picked it up and have used it as then a performance measurement in one way or another, which was not what was intended to do. So for the past 3 years, Autumn has led what we call a new metrics project in consultation with Unico in the UK and ACT in Canada to try to say, what are the right things for us to be publicly reporting about technology transfer, and how can we change that conversation? So over the last 3 years, you've seen Autumn do things like change how we report revenue in our report, change how we report disclosures, because what we found is that people would look at the columns, how we lined them up, would show research dollars in, disclosures, and licensing income, and assume those had a causal relationship in some way or another on an annual basis, which of course they do not at all. So Autumn has launched a number of new surveys, one called the Scope Resources Structure Survey, and one called the Transaction Survey. We're also doing MTA surveys. All these are meant to do, though, is try to get at what are the contexts beyond around a particular office, and how might you better understand that. Ideally, I think technology transfer offices should be identifying goals that they're meant to achieve, right? Is that maximizing jobs, maximizing income, maximizing relationships? And we should have questions against each of those goals so that you'd also be able to then identify your peers, not only in geographic area, but in the kinds of things that you are trying to achieve, because your resources should follow that.
Moving away from the prescriptive to understanding just how the process is working right now. I'd be interested to hear others' views on the panel of the extent to which these performance measures, both national and institutional, are really driving a lot of behavior, driving the bus here.
Well, I would like just to comment, yes. In my experience in the U.S., negotiating from the other side of the table, I have found that we've spent a lot of time various different parts of the university, and it's not always clear that everybody's acting in the same interest. So I can cite examples where, you know, there were all these apparently insurmountable legal obstacles, but suddenly you say, well, on a $1 million contract, you'll put in $50,000 for upfront patenting costs, and suddenly these insurmountable obstacles disappear. So it did seem to me that they were being driven by revenue generation, and that's what they were actually focused on, and not the interest of the researcher. And so I did feel that in some examples that there were inappropriate revenue goals which were actually distorting what was the good of the university. I won't name the
university. I've seen that as well, and I've actually, as a good example of what things should be like, I think you need to look at what industry-to-industry tech transfer happens. And I've actually been a recipient on the other side of the table from IBM, and working with them, even on a very large deal involving a huge portfolio of IP. By the way, the most valuable part of the IP book that I believed and IBM believed was know-how and not patents. And IBM likes to license know-how, by the way, because it doesn't expire. They can continue collecting fees on that long after all the patents involved go away. Dealing with them, even on a very complex deal, can happen very quickly. And I've never found that with licensing technology from a university. Nothing seems to happen quickly. And in fact, I was on a committee, put on a committee by a congressperson with Tom Thornhill. I don't know if you know that name, but he used to be Clinton's science and technology guy. You might know him from Berkeley. He's now at Berkeley temporarily. He's back in the White House. In any case, he said it's taking so long to transfer IP in the information technology world that it's no longer worthwhile by the time you get a deal put together and a lot of potential industrial clients are walking away. He said maybe in the IT space you might just put it in the public domain so it does some good. So I think we need to differentiate between like software, hardware, and biotech, because those have different time frames. And the other issue we see is that, you know, the payoff from a biotech patent is so far out there because of FDA issues that the tech transfer people have turned over twice, and, you know, tech transfer offices, and the people who get credit for it are long gone.
Now, Christina, do you have from the you know, both reflecting on your experience at you know, at Duke as well as Hopkins, maybe even back to Colorado, though talking about more the past 10 years or so, these performance measures, does that drive a lot of what the TTO officers do about the, you know, in handling?
Well, I think I appreciate what our panelist Tony said about just trying to accelerate the tech transfer opportunity. And I do think that money is helpful. I think the biggest costs in TTO offices are the patent costs, and particularly before provisionals were available, because then you're paying quite a lot for a patent before you know someone's interested. But then if you divulge the idea, then you lose international rights. And now with the delay in the patent office being up to 18 months before you can get an office action or more, depending, then you have to enter the national stage, and then you have to decide on international rights before you even know what the U.S. has said. So it's becoming a lot more complicated. I just think that one of the things, and I know this is another question, but I think it's all about aligning incentives with the ultimate outcome. And that's what I heard Tony and Richard saying. And you have to do it quickly. And so I think that if you understand where the president's coming from, where the provost's coming from, where the dean's coming from, where the faculty are coming from, and they're all very different, then you can find out who's the decision makers and what it means to get through. I actually think it'd be quite easy to make a standard contract, just a standard template for all universities to use, aligning those.
Do you think that a large company and a small company doing the deal with the university should be treated the same? Startup?
Well, I think it's different. I think, one, cash is king. In a startup, you want to give equity instead of cash. In a bigger company, you know, what does it mean to give necessarily equity? I don't know if you give stock options, which you don't do stock options anymore, but you might give cash. So I do think they're different.
What I'd like, Martin, and then I'd like to do is build on Rich's point regarding differences across different types of firms, and then return to this really important question of the incentives of the different actors. Martin, are you on one or a variant?
I'm going to go with the incentives issue.
Flexibly we'll move in that.
I think that this is the most important question. The TLO is structurally inside a university, and a university has company, but deans above you and people above you that may have very different goals than the TLO, larger goals. The TLO can get trapped in those sorts of situations. The other thing is, what is the incentive for the leader of a TLO who wants to go up career-wise?
Yeah.
Is there incentive to say, hey, when they go to the next job from, let's say, San Diego State to the University of California, being California, is it, I transferred all this technology, but I generated no money, license money, for San Diego State. Is that going to be interesting for the University of California? I think it's highly unlikely. So you have actually individual incentives, too, for the individual who wants to be successful and move career-wise. And that is almost always, it seems to me, going to be measured on revenue. Maybe not, but my guess is that in most cases, yes.
So we've talked about, I think this is important, and let's contrast the incentives, the individual level incentives of the TLO officer with the incentives as well of the other actors, including faculty, okay, administration, obviously firms, the guys on the other side of the deal here. Ed had a point.
What
I think what we're trying to do here is trying to understand as Martin was pointing out, the individual level incentives of the actors involved, just descriptively at this point. And so we've had one characterization of what the TLO officers may do, what they need to do to get ahead. The suggestion is, well, at least a part of that, and perhaps an important part of that metric for getting ahead may well be the kind of revenues, dollars, et cetera, whatever we might think of that. That's just the way it's working. Now, what about other actors? What about, say, university administration? What about particularly the faculty as well that these offices are interacting with? What's making all these guys tick?
Well, let me see if this resonates with anyone in the room, and Tony from the administration and faculty. How many faculty are in the room? Okay, so I'm going to really go out on a limb here, but... okay, so let's start with the president, and then we'll move from there. So in my view, a president, as a leader, has to have a vision for what the purpose of the university is, needs to raise resources to follow up on that vision, and is concerned about the reputation, so that if a big deal happens, like Lyrica at Northwestern, or the one at Emory, or at the University of Madison, that leads to marketing, which leads to reputation, which leads to more resources. So I think the university, in terms of, now let's get to money. A president is sort of interested in the 8 to 9 figure gift, all right? So let's put that aside, a chaired professorship, let's say. A provost usually gets stuck with the bill. So a provost is interested in recouping patent costs. They don't want to lose money. If they're enlightened, they want to support the faculty discovery. And in my view, make sure that the office is responsive. Now, a dean sort of gets stuck with the bill, but would love to have discretionary funding. So that might be in the 5 to 6 figure, because they want to support student projects. They want to support startup funds for faculty. They're there to serve the faculty and the students. And then finally, the faculty. Well, if the faculty were interested in money, we wouldn't be at a university, right? So I think the faculty are interested. Okay. I think that faculty are interested in research funding, especially in these difficult times, to bridge their program. I ran a research group with 25 people, and it cost me $1 million to make salary a year. So I think it's research funding, I think it's a nicer car and a vacation. Because I don't think any of the faculty, I've 129 U.S. and foreign patents, started 4 or 5 companies, some that are still alive, some that died, one that got sold. And so at the end of the day, if someone had just promised me a nice consulting gig, a day a week, a better car, and a vacation, I'd probably be about the same place where I am today. So that's what I think the incentives of the characters and actors are.
Other views, Tony, please?
Okay. I agree with the vision. I think the role of the university is to do research, but also it's part of the community, and I think especially in times like this, that it is an engine of creativity and innovation, and you should encourage the relatively few entrepreneurial academics to actually use their talents and come out. And so how you do that is tricky, and it's not necessarily taking a very legalistic view or doing expensive patents. One of the things that we found was there's a lot of innovation in the university, but it's not in a form that VCs can use. And so what they set up was an angel fund. It actually was a regional angel fund with 3 universities, which takes it from a research prototype to a stage where you could interest a VC.
Yes.
And that's crossing the chasm, if you like. And that's a role that really is useful. And the academics can see it's useful, because if they go to a VC with their little research prototype, either they won't be interested or else they'll take most of the equity. And if you can take it to a further stage, you can retain more equity. And that brings back to the university. So I think, yes, you really want some of these things to succeed, and I think you need some successes, whether it's with licensing or whether it's in startups, so people can see it's valuable. And actually, ideally, it can fund professors and more research in the university.
Tony, do you agree with Christina's suggestion that met with some subdued opinions out here, the faculty are delighted with a nice vacation in a car, and that's about it.
Bridge
Bridge funding. Okay, and mainly research funding.
Yeah, research.
So I went back to my university after having left a few years ago, and the guy who I appointed to run this office, I was on his appointing committee, tells me there's now 13 millionaires in the faculty in the university. Now, they're probably not millionaires after the stock market crash, but maybe dollar millionaires.
The pound dollar exchange rate has been very good.
But I think that exactly proves my point. On $1 million at 5% interest, $50,000 a year, you got a great vacation and a nice car and some extra pocket change. It's not a life-changing amount of money.
Well, there are some people who want to be the next Steve Jobs or something like that, next Bill Gates.
That's like why our athletes that come to universities think they're going to play in the NBA or the WNBA. It's the same kind of one in a thousand.
Yes.
But it's the dream, which is important.
Sure. And there's a lot of faculty, I think, that I've been seeing that do really interesting things that industry now is willing to give gifts to. And they can be pretty substantial.
Absolutely, and I think that's true. But also note that Steve Jobs and Bill Gates didn't graduate from college.
Absolutely, yeah.
So you're not going to find them in colleges.
No, indeed.
So you're suggesting then that among the faculty, you don't see the kind of behavior that you might see in the private sector. Let's call it the swinging for the fences, trying to get the conditioning their behavior in order to get that sort of payoff.
I think they self-selected to be a faculty member. They're not those risk takers.
Okay.
Well, I think they care passionately about their research,
right.
and that's the reason they're there, and they care about teaching. But actually, if they have a good idea of research, they would like to see it taken to the next stage. I mean, that's why I find it interesting in Microsoft. You know, we produce lots of software in the university, but actually taking it to a product which is used by millions is an extremely satisfying thing to go do. And I think that is a motivation for academics, but their primary motivation for being an academic is, I think, their love of the subject.
So, now, an interesting data point, by the way, is that, first of all, 60%, and this is a number I got from the National Venture Capital Association, 60% of successful entrepreneurs were not born in the United States, U.S. entrepreneurs.
That's true.
And a number I got from Price Waterhouse is that 85% of startup companies that might have licensed their technology from a university for royalties change direction before they're successful and never use the IP they licensed.
That is exactly what we found, that you know, we had a mistaken policy of licensing to a startup, and the last thing they want to do is pay heavy things, so they choose to avoid and not use the code. And so that is why we stopped that policy. And
do you license for equity?
We do equity. And what the office does, it puts together a marketing person, it brings together the CEO, because that's not what an academic does typically.
Yes.
It's very rare that you find an academic who can be the CEO or the marketing person.
From the venture side, we find that absolutely.
I bet you do, yes. Yes.
So let's try to bring some of these remarks together. We've talked about the incentives of the administration, which, and even there, we find some heterogeneity, the president versus the provost, who doesn't want to be bleeding red, and so on. The faculty, how well aligned, this gets back to Martin's earlier question, how well aligned are the incentives of the way TTOs are currently structured with these diverse incentives, or does one set of these have the heavy foot? And this might also speak to the question of reporting structures as well. Within universities. So Dana, if you might consider that.
I think that Christina's comment about patent costs falling to the provost is really a driver for the technology transfer offices, in that in the technology transfer offices are told overall you have to cover your costs, right? And whether that's covering your salary or not usually doesn't become a concern, but we can't go into the deficit. I think that then becomes a detriment to doing some of the more creative types of things, because I agree that otherwise a lot of technology transfer officers are very happy to get relationships and resources which help the university out at any level, right? But then where you start to see the misalignment is more with other universities within the office, right? So if I have the opportunity to bring in gift money or sales money, or technology transfer licensing money or research money, it's all green, right?
Well, they
and
count
that's
the
all
same.
Fine. And they all count the same for my particular office, but other offices inside the university may not feel the same way, right? So you may have a development officer who thinks if they don't get their particular pound of flesh from that particular person, when the transaction would actually be better done as a license in order to make the company more successful, then you run into challenges.
So these are challenges across the different units and
right.
the possible conflicting incentives.
Right, and that's where you see some universities, like the University of Minnesota, now setting up a front door, right, for the university to try to better align the overall metrics to external communities in that way. And I tried to check in with them to see how well that's going, but I wasn't able to reach them before this conference.
I have a question for some of the university
sure.
people on the panel, and that is, what does the university do as far as protecting IP that they license, especially if they license fields of use to several industrial companies? Who has to pay for patent defense?
It depends on, usually that's covered in the agreement, and universities have the right to either enjoin or not, and they therefore will share or not if any of the results of the licensing. If I could come back, I think Tony said something really important, which is something that could be a possible, at least one thing that's really important, that came out. And that is, you talked about crossing the chasm, and I think that where universities have a difficult time is getting faculty to do that prototype with the funding to actually build something that they can take, and an entity that can help get a customer, because from my interactions with VCs, what they want to see is that you have a customer. I mean, in fact, one of the major VCs from Kleiner Perkins said to me, I don't need to see a business plan. You bring me a customer, and you tell me what the market is, and I'll fund you. And that was very tempting. So I think the entity you're talking about generally is not within a university, because, again, it's an expensive item. But if there was a way, and we tried to set this up in North Carolina, it was a regional resource. It is there, Southeast Tech Adventures, and it works with Duke, North Carolina, and UNC. And what it does is allow entities to come in, faculty or students, build prototypes. It has labs. It brings in angel funding and then gets it to a point where you can either go and get VC funding, which several companies have, or not, and then eventually either license, create jobs, be sold, go public.
But, Christina, we've talked about the incentives of faculty to do their research. How does that work? Do the faculty have the incentives to go? I mean, they want to move on to the next research project. They may not want to, build the prototype that's actually going to allow things to move to the next
that's
step.
Why
so I'm not sure. So how are these incentives working?
So
can you get postdocs to do that part?
Yes, you can. And, in fact, that's the model is that the postdocs are usually quite interested in taking the ideas out and forming a company. But I think it's got to be a set of standalone entity that's attached to the university.
Yeah.
Serves the local universities. And the question is, how do we fund it? I mean, it was really tough to get Southeast Tech Adventures funded. And Angels funded it, and the state helped them.
Right. But how do you
get forward, that's going to even be more difficult, because right now, early stage venture funding is falling off a cliff. I mean, last quarter, we had 94 deals in the United States, which I believe is about a 40-year low in early stage funding.
But my question, I still don't understand the response to, it sounds like you need the fact that you're saying, the postdocs will do.
Postdocs and students tend to be pretty excited. They tend to be younger, a little maybe more risk-taking. Faculty have their labs, and they want to like the.
Well, the faculty put in enough effort to make that next step
The other thing to do is look at aligning what you need done with their academic mission already, right? So I've worked with a number of faculty where if we can generate revenue through site licenses, right, or through gifts in some way or another for early access to what's going on, you return that to the research, then that is, again, something that they can see moving forward. So at the University of Washington, we did that with three or four different projects where we licensed, again, not commercial access, but site-based access to companies, returned all of that money to the university research project. They then developed prototype after prototype after prototype because they were continually to generate data and publications that they were able to use for their own promotion and tenure. And I'm sure we'll get to the promotion and tenure question later, because the incentives have to align in that way.
Well, why don't you I mean, we're on the subject of incentives. It sounds like an appropriate spot to talk about promotion and tenure. And this is surely speaks to the question of, you know, the incentives of the faculty here. Yes, they're interested in research, but they're interested in promotion and tenure. So how does that play into this process?
Okay, well, I can say something, although the tenure system in the UK is somewhat different than the US. And just one parenthetical remark about the Angel Fund, the way that our universities got it, it was because Gordon Brown, when he was treasurer, actually set up a thing, that a competition that universities could apply and compete to get an Angel Fund, and that's something this government could do.
Absolutely, yeah, I'm trying to get our government.
Okay, you've got a new government coming.
That's a great suggestion.
So let's be careful about too much government venture funding. The history of government venture capital funds is a disaster, state-level disaster. In various countries, a disaster. Money just squandered. Now, I'm sure in Lake Wobegon, where everybody is above average, then they all work. Unfortunately,
it can work and it can fail, yes.
I think the history of government VC funding, direct VC style funding, grant funding, et cetera, and not SBIRs and STTRs, has been a failure. SBICs were a failure.
Can you stop talking in acronyms?
Tony, you're in Washington.
SBICs are small business investment corporations, and the government would give a small venture fund a 2-to-1 match on any private equity that they could raise, but the government had no political influence on where the money went. Whereas a lot of the state funds that I've met with, the state government had such political pressure to try to distribute it equally around every county in the state.
No, I can imagine, yes. I think it could work, but let's go back to the tenure question, which was actually the original question. So, again, it has to be, you know, in your job objectives or whatever it is. So academics typically get measured on publications, they get measured on teaching, of course, but they also get measured on patents, and it's actually explicit that that's a form of something that they're measured on.
Well, actually, not. Let's go to a university.
That is in my university.
Oh, in your university.
Right. That was actually the case.
I see.
That's a fact. All right.
I think that's not typical. In the U.S., in the major research universities, that how patents are considered, if the university folks among you for the U.S. could consider not just your own institutions, but to the degree that you have an understanding broadly.
I have a quick comment here. I've been in a bunch of faculty clubs, and I think the major point of patents is bragging rights in the faculty club.
To some extent, that's true. Okay.
Though publication in science or nature, et cetera, might be a little bit up the pecking order, but that's for you folks to comment on. Christina?
I won't be defensive. you know, I think that my advice, both as a professor, dean, and provost, would be to faculty is not to get involved in startups before they get tenure. Because I think that in the U.S., there's a thing called the H factor. Does everybody know about the H factor? So this is a number by which the number of publications you have that's cited by the same number. So if you have an H factor of 10, for example, that means you have 10 publications that are cited at least 10 times. In the National Academy, getting the National Academies, you need an H factor somewhere around at least 20. And then you look at the impact factor of the journals you're publishing in, you know, Nature versus, or as opposed to others. So I think that it's important to establish a career and not to get sidetracked, because once you go down that path of trying to commercialize the technology and you start to get a little bit of success, it kind of snowballs in terms of your time, and it becomes more of a conflict of attention. But having said that, when I was a student at Stanford as an undergraduate, it was clear that everybody knew that only faculty that were the top 3 in the world would get tenure. Well, the time I finished and graduated and came back from my postdoc, the joke was, if you haven't taken two companies public by the time you're up for tenure, you're not going to get tenure. And it changed that fast in a decade. Now, that was West Coast. Been out on the East Coast, and I think that at our university that I was at Duke, I think the provost there was very forward-thinking and did take into account cross-disciplinary research and other changes since the Bayh-Dole Act, as well as the number of patents you have. Then, having been at a university in the middle, it's not clear that at the University of Colorado, when I started out as an assistant professor and an associate professor, that it was almost considered sometimes you work with industry. You know, you're never going to get a publication in JAX, for example, by doing that. And so I think that's something that is, it's kind of changing all over the country.
Martin, I'd like you to, in addition to whatever you were going to say, also lead off on, we've talked about the different interests, incentives of the different actors here, and we're going to get to firms in more detail in a moment. But to what extent do you see these different incentives, particularly the ones that seem to have bite, aligned with the broader, what might be argued, the broader social mission of it, advancing innovation in society more broadly?
I just have one question. Kathy is from Stanford. Someone who doesn't have two startups could not get tenure there?
I said that in jest as a joke. It was a joke.
No, but I think it's people who are saying this. I think we need to be really careful. I mean, at the great universities, it isn't about your patents, and it isn't about your startups. At maybe secondary universities, maybe that's more important. I just think we need, and that is what's made these universities great. And when we start thinking about trying to change those incentives, in some way, some people are saying, I'm reading in some of the academic literature that patents should be counted towards tenure. I'm reading
They are now.
Well, again, it depends where.
Engineering faculties, I think, are more tenured.
Perhaps in engineering.
Okay. Kathy is shaking her head no. Ed has...
Sorry? Absolutely. I chair a promotion tenure committee, and I've served on promotion tenure committees at three universities. We absolutely count them as much as we count papers.
At all three schools?
Yeah.
It's actually
in some ways more work than a paper.
If we could have Kathy's head shake be verbalized.
I think it's an observed fact, and I agree with you. I think it's a measure of, if you were to look at most of the National Academy members, at least in engineering, because people that I know at Duke or my institution, when the H factor article came out in Nature, it's a little article, they did the calculation and found that, that happened to be indicative. So I agree with you.
Kathy, you had an opinion on
too literal about this. When you count, I don't mean you actually count. I mean, do you take it into consideration that they count? Well, I don't know. I think you could count if the patent is worthwhile. Has it been licensed? Does anybody care about it? I think Jim probably does know.
I mean, I've talked with Bill about this. Miller is ex-provost. And he said, no.
let's sort of pop this discussion up about 15 to 20,000 feet here. We've talked about the different incentives. It's not necessarily a consensus, but given the messiness of all this, how aligned are they with the broader kind of what you might call social welfare mission of the public interest here? How well are these different incentives and actors lined up with advancing innovation, putting it, getting it out into society for social good? Martin, why don't you take a shot at that?
Certainly. I'll call them tech licensing laws, if you can call them tech transfer laws. I'll call them tech licensing laws. I think that's better, because they're only a very minor part at any time of the total transfer of technology out of the university. They absolutely are. They can't be controlling all tech transfer. And so it seems to me at one level we have a problem that I see when I talk to faculty is that there are some superb tech licensing offices with superb people in them, and then there are the average. And the average tend to be, this is a generalization, but I think the research is risk averse, procrastinating, and frustrating to deal with.
Is that because they're mostly lawyers?
There's a very few attorneys, actually.
It also depends on where they are structured in the university, what the university president's goals really are, or the provost or someone. But they're in these organizations, and if you're in a public university, their organizations are constantly changing.
And the experience level, I would add.
Of the university is changing. The TLO is often changing. And what happens is the TLOs that frustrate faculty, immediately the word goes out among the faculty that you don't want to deal with these folks. And then you start, and because of the way faculty can work structurally, they can go out in the gray market and move things out of the gray market. And then you have problems of the TLO now trying to control faculty in a way that it's very hard for them to enforce the rules upon the faculty, because it has to go up the hierarchy. So I think one has to think, I try to think about this structurally. Where are the structures? How are the control patterns? So in a corporation like Microsoft, to some degree, you can tell your researcher, to some degree, depending on how good they are, you can't do this anymore. And to some degree, they have to go along with you as the executive. In a university, that's impossible, because the professor is going to go out and get the grant from NSF, and if the provost doesn't like it, as long as I'm not violating any protocols, I can go ahead and do it. So I think we also have to think about, how is the professor structured? A lot of the modeling in the economics literature has been modeling them as employees, and they're not. Well, they are, but they're not.
Yeah.
In the same way as an employee in the private sector, or even a dean. Deans can be fired.
Having said that, Microsoft Research, which Rick Rashid set up, I mean, he modeled it on CMU's computer science department, and actually he believes in hiring smart people, and, you know, smarter than yourself if you get it, and they actually go and motivate themselves. So actually, I don't know that I've seen someone said you can't do that area of research, but clearly there are incentives, and you get marked if you transfer some technologies, but you also get multiple publications.
Let's build on Martin's point regarding the gray market. By that, I assume he means faculty going around the university tech licensing, commercialization office, however you might want to characterize it, themselves, going around the administration. One, you know, how pervasive is that? How important is that? What does that reflect about, you know, the way the institution is structured? Maybe some of the industry folks here have been on the receiving end.
I think it's a great thing, actually, going around. It simplifies the negotiation process. There's another party taken out of the loop, and things happen much faster. And I've even
been involved with a case where the dean was involved in going around the administration.
Was not me.
Let me,
if I can respond to that, because I actually think that it's not a good, obviously not a good thing. And I don't think it really happens, well, I think there's a built-in mechanism to prevent it from happening, because if you license technology, at some point, people that are savvy that want to start up a company are going to ask for a clean bill of health on this faculty member and their technology before most venture capitalists, I think, would do that, or at least the ones that I've dealt with, they wanted a clean bill of health. So I think that any faculty who does it, they might do it once, but I think that it's not going to be as successful from my experience.
I think it's more the general counsel's problem at every university than it is the technology transfer office. The technology transfer office is not the police, right? And what the bigger problem is with faculty taking things out the back door is that they are often not only taking their own rights, right? So they're taking rights of graduate students or they're taking rights of their junior colleagues. And so it is the technology transfer's office and the general counsel's office to help clear that title, as Christina said. And my experience is that when things leave in some way that they weren't supposed to, they often always have some way of getting back in, right? And then you run into the conflict of interest problems, or then you start running into the problems of how do you then give a clean bill of health to the venture capitalist who wants to fund that, who wants to make sure the university's not going to come back and sue that company once it's discovered in that way.
But you're all assuming that the patent is involved. What if it's just know-how?
If it's know-how, the universities don't own that anyway, right? We have no way to tie university professors to chairs and say, give us all your know-how, right? We own patents, we own some type of copyright, and we may own some data or some trademark rights in that way. I will never, ever license know-how.
You won't?
No. How do I tell it's transferred? How do I prove that?
Yeah, Tony?
Come back here. So I agree with Martin. I've seen this many times, that if you have a technology transfer office which is too heavy-handed in trying to do it, then you know,
or incompetent.
Well, too legalistic, for example. You know, saying that academics been working, I don't know, with a company like Rolls Royce for 10 years, and then the office say you can't talk to them without being there. That's not credible. And yet these companies come and invest and set up centres in your university, which is what you'd like. It's a form of technology transfer. So I do think there are all these things, and I it's easy to caricature a technology transfer office as being bad, but I think you have to be relaxed. You know, they can't commercialize all the technology transfer coming out of a university, but they have to show they can help, and people have a choice. And so if you've gone to the office and they say, well, they can't help, then you should be able to go to a VC yourself and do things yourself. So I think universities need to be a bit more relaxed, and the technology transfer office need to be rather selective in how they work. It can work.
And universities then need measures also that recognize all of that. I mean, technology transfer officers would agree with everything that you say, that all technology does not come through the tech transfer office. It can't and it shouldn't. And there are many ways for universities to have impact.
So here's my proposition. Inventor ownership on the patents. The TLOs prove their excellence. The inventors will come to them because a lot of inventors don't want to go out and commercialize it anyway.
Why?
We flip it from university ownership to inventor ownership, then the TLOs. I think the excellent TLOs will probably get researchers from other universities coming to them, in fact, inventors. Because that would be my proposition.
This is TLO as spin-out itself, I see.
Yeah,
okay.
It is.
Tony, you had a...
I'm curious as to why you think it's reasonable for the inventors of you know, publicly funded grant and in the infrastructure of a university to have the whole IP themselves. I don't happen to think that's reasonable. And Cambridge was an example, but actually you can do perfectly good spin-outs, technology transfer, licensing with the university owning and having some sort of deal with the academics. I think that's perfectly
good. Great, Tony. So let me just respond.
Sure.
How about 10% automatic ownership to the university as the compensation to the university, and then have inventor ownership?
But that's typically what, in my view, most universities have. If they have a deal by the first N million you get from your invention. It's split, you know, the academic gets 80%, the university gets 10%, and the faculty gets 10%, something like that. So that's typically the sort of deal. deals they have, that the researcher gets most of the money.
If I can return to alternatives, David.
Well, I'm talking about the ones that I know in the UK, right? And I can certainly give you chapter and verse on that if you like.
It is usually quite different.
The best I've seen is about one-third of the faculty.
After. That seems to be very mean.
A third is about the common. Yeah.
Christina would like to make a remark here.
Oh, yeah, I'm just following up on, Martin, on your suggestion when I read your paper, Reconsidering the Bayh-Dole Act, and I actually, in the Q&A, I have a question for the audience on that. But coming back to who owns it, I know that we have the model now, and you're proposing these two alternative models, and one of them is the faculty own it, but... So I would agree that there's no one more passionate about technology than an inventor. I mean, they're the ones that they will go and they will die on the vine for their idea. That doesn't mean that they should, though. And I would say not only are they most passionate, but in some cases they're also the least likely to really commercialize it. Even though they have a PhD, they don't necessarily understand how to start a company, how to get it funded, how to manage employees and all those. So I think that the whether you call it the TTO or the TLO, I think that the advantage is that you build relationships with people with proven track records that can help do the commercialization. So I actually think, and I'll hold up my hand, guilty as charged, that we as the inventor should not be the CEOs of these companies.
I think that it becomes a question of what area in the university do you want to fund. If you have more inventor ownership, you should have a bigger ombuds office. You got to have a bigger conflict of interest office. Right, because what you're going to have is more complaints from people who have their rights they perceive taken away or being tromped on in some way. You're going to have more problems with probably faculty competing against each other or having cross patents in some way. Right, so you're going to have more CREATE Act issues if you understand the CREATE Act in that way. And you're going to have more conflict of interest problems where you're going to have perhaps more use of university facilities for private gain. That's more or less a concern for some universities. But you're going to have more, perhaps, company business being done on university time.
Let me ask a question, and I want to eventually move the discussion to a more descriptive one back away from alternatives in a moment, which is how well currently things are set up for dealing with different types of firms, et cetera. So I want to get there. But building on this, we know that it's the minority of tech transfer, TLOs, TTOs, whatever, offices that actually operate cover calls, okay? And certainly a very small minority that actually yield substantial revenue. Should we entertain almost a centralization of that function? Does every university need a TLO? Can certain aspects of that function be regionalized or centralized in some form? So again, in the spirit of entertaining different models, but moving to this one, should we rethink this organization, particularly in light of this? You know, it's not worth it for most universities.
I very strongly believe we do need some kind of regionalization, because what I'm finding from the outside is that it's rare that a university has sufficient IP for a field to cover that field thoroughly. Especially with all the cross-discipline stuff coming along, like nanotechnology, you know, university says, yeah, we've got really core IP on a particular object, but it's usually not the case. I can find, you know, two or three others that have pieces of it that I really would like to include. And I've actually been involved with a deal that involved a public California university, a FFRC, federally funded research center, and NASA. And years it took to work out a deal that made sense for all those parties, and there should be some way of making that happen easier.
But regionalization wouldn't solve that problem. Regionalization, the way I think we're mostly talking about it, is physical regionalization rather than sectoral. Let's say this kind of security software, one national operation. I think we're in the United States. We mean geographical regions, and.
Even if it's geographical, couldn't they have inter-regional fixed agreements?
It could be field centralization.
It could be field.
It need not be geography.
Let's think broadly about the question.
Let's think broadly.
Yes. So let me just say about what I would be concerned about the geographical centralization is there aren't that many geographies that have a number of great research universities. I can think of the Bay Area. I can think of Boston and then San Diego with the Salk, Scripps, et cetera, et cetera. But beyond that, you know, even the Washington area, a number of great, but perhaps not quite the same as the Bay Area. But the real issue there is, I'm sorry, I'm a California chauvinist, we will have an earthquake and move off into the Pacific. We're waiting for it. But I think the question is, how close does a tech transfer officer need to be to the researchers? I mean, with 50, 60 miles away, which would be 40 miles, let's say, Berkeley and Stanford, that's an hour right there. How important is it to be in that environment very deeply as a tech transfer or tech licensing
officer? Could they have a person
office?
In each university?
Let's reframe it a little bit. To say centralization of the function, I think we have to be careful and think that the function has different dimensions to it, right? So maybe there's some aspects, perhaps addressing some of Rich's concerns. Hey, you know, we have to be able to realize certain critical mass and scale economies with respect to IP by field of use and so on. But per your point, could it be that you still need somebody on the ground, right? Interacting in a regular kind of where communication is dense and so on, and the relations with the faculty are there. So again, we can think. I'm just throwing that out as a possibility. Again, thinking broadly about these times.
Go back to the one of the provocative things I've tried to say this morning, which is that the TLO or the TTO is to the scientists and engineers like the libraries, the humanists. I mean, we're going through these same conversations with what is the role of the library in the university. And, you know, people aren't building physical space libraries. And so as we go more to online telepresence and these kind of technologies, you know, something like this might be quite workable. But again, it's how close are you to serving faculty and graduate students and postdocs.
Great.
Well, and one of the other issues you brought up, though, was the career path for technology licensing people. After you get to the top of your technology licensing in a big university, where do you go? What's
with one of the step? Startups? No, I don't know. Kathy, where do you go?
There you go.
But there's no way above the TLO.
Well, you could leave to the private sector, perhaps.
No, actually, it
would never be higher.
we have two participants. Audience, please, and then Bob, subsequent. Oh, yes. Could you please say, good point, before you speak, if you could just say who you are and your affiliation. Christina,
just recently.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Duke University, member of the committee.
Yep. Good to see you. Yeah. Yes. I'll let Dana respond to that, but I just want to say one thing, and that is going back, Jennifer and Bobby, what you're saying. So, you know, and Kathy knows this because I started a company a couple years ago called Spark IP, and that was exactly the idea, is not only centralize it, put it online, make it responsive, maybe it could be web-based, have faculties have their little, you know, electronic notebooks, and then immediately go from idea to provisional to patent, and have then, the model is that all the IP, all the patents from the U.S. Patent Office are on this. Use Web 2.0 clustering tools. If you're interested in the area, it'll pull up all the patents in the area across all the universities, and I think Stanford has all their patents download on it. And then, if you're interested in licensing, you can go to the TTO. Ultimately, I really wanted it to be eBay meets Facebook, where you let the marketplace decide what the value of the IP should be. And there is a marketplace, but it's not quite realizing what I'd hope it to be. But anyway, this is not an infomercial for that, because that was in my previous life. But I think it's important that you can do this. You can put it all online. You can actually make it regional. And we should be doing it in the virtual world, without a doubt. And that's a little bit with where some libraries are going. Now, the interesting thing about sharing books, my last little thing, is I actually think, in terms of library efficiency, we should hire UPS in order to store all the books and send all the books out, because they've got the logistics down in a way that none of our university systems know how to work. But that's a different topic.
This is going a little... Okay. Yes, now, by the way, just as a remark, we have we're able to go to 10:15, accounting for audience participation. There are other questions I want to pose for the panelists, but given that we're already in audience participation, which is terrific, plan on 10:15. Name and affiliation, please. So the implication being that you don't want it, you want it to be university specific. That's right. Okay, I see. So you lose the branding advantage. Right. Sure. I hear. Interesting. Good. And, well, so put the coaches at. Never mind. Name and affiliation.
right, in that patents are not the only way to achieve success. And technology transfer officers, I think, would be the first to agree with you, right? What we face is every time a faculty member comes to our door and wants to do something, they have in their mind patent because they hear from companies, they hear from others, patents are the currency, right? They hear that's what they believe. So when I start talking, with them and say, let's not patent this, let's look at how we can release this as a copyrighted work, how we have software that's useful, how we have information assets, which can be used to establish the relationships, they're like, well, what about the patent though? Right? So that it's very challenging. It costs you more money and time to say no, in some instances, than it is to say yes.
This goes back to one of Christina's early points, which is often the faculty have a view of the commercial potential, presumably of their discoveries, et cetera, that's really not grounded, okay, in expertise in the commercial sector. So here we have yet another conflict, right, where interests are not entirely aligned, and I think that's right, because my understanding of a lot of TLOs is that part of their job is to say no. We can't get this, or we can't find somebody who will license. Therefore, you know, we won't even go through the early steps. Yeah. It is premised around the patent IP. Good point.
And I'm not sure regionalization, though, is a cost reducer. I mean, So you look at Canada, right? Canada has regionalized on a provincial basis, right? Every province has their own network, and I think they have increased resources because they're allowed now to have very specialized resources that they would not have otherwise. If you look in the U.S. at the regional offices, which existed primarily at system level, University of California, SUNY, Wisconsin, most of these are breaking up, right? Because the campuses want to have that local help. They want to have the provost or the dean wants to be able to call up their own employee and say, have you done this, right? And then they have better coordination inside the university with some of these other offices. I talked earlier about some of the conflicts between development, between research, between tech transfer. It's easier to mediate those inside the university than it is external. But on the other hand, I mean, I agree that we have a lot of field-like centralization, and I think more of that could be occurring. Certainly you see intellectual ventures, right, which has its good points and its bad points, but it's doing some centralization of IP in the IT area, right? And some universities are thinking more and more about providing licenses to them. Then that company can license out to others in that particular area. Biotech doesn't seem to have the same desire to do that kind of thing.
I'd like to build on that, and I'd like to flip this over a little bit, something that we haven't really addressed yet, which is, and for these questions I throw it to Richard and Tony, which in your view and your experience, how well is the university system currently, not prescriptively, we're talking about how well is it working right now across universities, being able to, you know, observe across universities with technology commercialization and licensing in general. But then, per your point about biotech versus IT, Dana, the differences, how are they only suited for, are best suited for life sciences, not particularly well suited for IT and other domains? So what are differences across technologies, and then we can add to that, how well are they set up to deal with firms of different types, of the large established firms, or the smaller firms, or the spin-outs that they may be also negotiating with, sometimes with their own faculty. So that's a lot of stuff, and I'm going to, Rich, if you could lead off.
You know, I think at least 90% and maybe 96%, something like that, of patents the universities file probably shouldn't be filed. And I don't know how you narrow that down. It's very hard. Maybe you have a marketing advisory board from industry that reviews what has potential value. You know, you have to get people with, you know, obviously conflict of interest issues settled, and very difficult situation. But something needs to be done to reduce this mass filing of patents that, in fact, I can tell you of many cases where professors file a patent and they think they know what the market is. But actually, you know, like in a couple of cases that actually I was involved with, they thought it was an
IT area, information technology area, but it turned out to be a better suited to a life science market. They had no clue about that. And professors are probably the least market knowledgeable people I've met. And I don't know how you can bring in that, but I think that's something, some kind of an external volunteer board or something.
What we have a couple of, and we want to keep this brief because we do only have about 25 minutes left. David, then John, then right, then Jennifer.
Well, I mean, it depends if it's done strictly on an economic basis. I didn't. And then you have an issue of, you know, economic versus, you know, good of the greater good of the people. And maybe for the greater good of the people, you don't need a patent. You know, that's something you want to put in the public domain. And maybe that's a recommendation of this advisory board. Certain things need to go in the public domain. Certain things should be protected. Certain things, you know, one of the issues that also gets involved is who funded the research and what are they going to do? You know, I was involved with a deal where the university was funded by the Department of Energy, and they put all kinds of restrictions on this because the companies interested were outside the United States. They were actually in China. And boy, when you get patents, the Department of Energy in China involved, you've hit the wall. I mean, there's not a deal.
John Walsh, Georgia Tech. Jennifer, briefly, please. There's a brief comment back then. I want to throw it to Tony. A bunch of this. Yes, name and affiliation, please. You had a hand up? Okay. Tony, and if you might respond to that, but also I want you to say, in your experience at Microsoft, how well set up are these TLOs to really, you know, move ahead in moving innovation out into spheres where they can have social impact? Are they well organized? And then I'd like to hear a little bit about differences perhaps between, if you can, hardware versus software, IT versus, Rich might have something to say about biotech, but go ahead.
Well, I'll answer at least some of those questions. I think there is a difference between biotech and IT, and so in my experiences at Microsoft in negotiating with TLOs or TTOs, it does seem that they are obsessed by the fact that you're going to get a big biotech patent and you could get lots of money, and they seem to see software patents in the IT space in the same vein. And in fact, that's not the way, you know, a product may have many patents and each one individually is not worth. There isn't a blockbuster patent in the same way. And so I do feel that's an obstacle because they don't recognize the differences between the different fields. And so I think that is a problem. Secondly, about industrial advice, we set up deliberately a company called Southampton Innovations Limited, which had VCs on it. John Fairclough from IBM was one of my mentors. He was Rothschild's venture capital at the time, and a number of other people on. And they advised the university. They were responsible for commercializing the IP, and then they were responsible. They were not for profit. They gave their profits back to the university because the university is a charity, so there was a legal deal to do that. And the third point is about the TTO, TLO functions. They were split. They had a licensing function, which, you know, is involves some legalistic things and so on. And then there was a rather more entrepreneurial part, which was really to do with spin-outs. And there, it addresses the career path. There you got people who really wanted to go into private industry, who wanted the opportunity. You had this great technology in these universities, and wow, they could help make it a company. And they could go and get a job. So they actually, you got these rather entrepreneurial people who stayed a few years, that did a couple of spin-outs and put together, you know, CEOs, marketing, and all this sort of stuff that an academic needs. But then they went off in one of these companies. And then you have people coming in. So you had the licensing part, which is the sort of traditional conservative stuff, which is probably necessary. But you also had these rather entrepreneurial types who actually saw it as a career path because they got access into the ground level with, you know, equity in a startup which could go places.
So
and that seems to me something you might want to consider.
How well are TLOs in the U.S. now set up to deal with your not just different types of firms, but almost different career paths and aspirations of the actors that are involved?
Well, I haven't seen anything quite like that. I mean, obviously, some universities are extremely successful in the U.S. at that. What they also did, they did deals with venture capital, you know, private venture capital. Yes, there was, as Martin Monk liked, there was some public stuff there too, but they also did deals with private venture capitalists and gave them, you know, privileged access to some of these technologies.
Interesting.
Could the people in these offices get equity in this spin-outs they created?
Yes.
And see, now that's a good incentive. They're both been on the same side of the table. They all want success.
So, Tony, if we can flip it over a little bit, this is very interesting, but then in your work with Microsoft, what's your, you know, dealing with a large established firm where you're really talking about, my sense is that the preponderance of activity in TLOs nationwide are not with spinning out new ventures, but actually with doing deals, licensing, et cetera, to larger established firms. So on that, how do they do, you know, at least in your experience?
Well, I don't know the percentage in the U.S. between the licensing to large firms and doing spin-outs. There must be some numbers.
Somebody here might have that on the tip of their tongue.
Right. I think that more licenses as a whole are to large companies.
Right.
But then, of course, spin-outs themselves are anywhere from probably 5 to 20% of a particular university's portfolio. And then small companies are counted separately, so then that would be probably my guess would be 30% or something.
Okay, so the preponderance are with larger companies. But if you can comment, established firms, if you can comment on your view of how well they've been set up in the diversity of experience, because you've dealt with any number of universities while at Microsoft.
Well, I have been surprised at a deal that I would have accepted as dean at the university, which we've been trying to negotiate an IP agreement with universities, that they are extremely resistant to what I think is a remarkably fair deal. Right? But that's from my experience as an academic, because I saw deals which were much worse. but by and large, the university keeps the IP, and you have a non-exclusive license, and that's something that we've been discussing actually with other IT companies. Would there be some interest in the IT companies like Intel, Microsoft, and a few others getting together and putting a standard thing and saving all this hassle, putting something that both sides thought was fair? Uh-huh. Uh-huh. So that's something that we have been talking about.
That's right.
And we could take it forward.
Sure, Christina, please.
No, I was just thinking, Jennifer, I want to follow up on your question. You know, we're moving into a very similar economy that existed when Bayh-Dole was passed, right? I mean, I was listening to the radio on the way in.
Backwards, yeah.
I mean, we're definitely moving backwards. The economy is contracting at 4%. If that continues for a year, we're in a lot of trouble. So what I like what you're proposing, which is I think the only solution, and I think that universities and industry, we need a fundamentally different approach now. We have got to innovate in this country. And how we do innovation now in 2008 has got to be different than we've done it before, in my view. So a closer relationship with the university industry and government. So the university and industries, they do these mega investment deals. So it lines up the incentives. The presidents of the university get the prestige. Provosts don't have to pay for the patents. The dean get a small fee that it's a non-exclusive, but they pay a small fee to prevent an exclusive going to someone. And the faculty gets the research. And who pays for it? We had a great opportunity. On October 24th of 2004, the American Job Creation Act was signed by President Bush. That allowed companies to repatriate foreign earned income in other countries at 5%. We brought billions back to this country. If the companies, and I advocated for this on every board meeting I went to, and they all said, thank you very much, sit down, Miss Academic. But if they would have taken that money and created $10 billion institutes, multi-university, addressing the major problems of the world, energy, infrastructure, water, you name it, food, poverty, we would have fundamentally changed the way we are today 4 or 5 years later. And what happened to that money? That money just replaced on a balance sheet. They either bought back stock or they paid for the R&D they were going to do anyway, and it's gone. And I think the new administration coming in may have a similar opportunity to once again do another AJCR, and therefore have the companies get the advantage of getting a ROFR, first right of refusal, versus they're non-exclusive. I could go on in acronyms, but I do think it's a new era. There's a new opportunity, and it will require all of us to think carefully and think about new policy for the administration going forward. So I like your idea.
What about the option of the potential of changing the patent law that's going through the system now? I mean, there's a lot of discussions in Congress, I can tell you about that. And, then the KSR decision last year, that's really changed the way venture capitalists look at patents.
Yeah. Marshall Phelps, Microsoft, also a member of the committee. Please, Mark. Puts that to rest for the time being. If I could ask, we're talking about alternative models here, and a possibility that's been raised here and also raised from the audience as well is, forget this IP stuff. Let's just, throw it all into the public domain. Whether you want to call that open source or not, different names can be applied to it. But Martin, can you lead off on that as a the pluses and minuses of that that sort of approach?
Okay, in my paper, I say that's a possibility.
Right.
My paper, that's I certainly argue that that's a possibility. All university inventions
are just opened up. The information just flows out. There's no patenting of any of it. And on a number of inventions that have generated an enormous amount of money for universities, for specific universities, those inventions would have been used anyway. The monoclonal antibodies out of Cambridge was not patented. It was used by everyone. Cohen-Vayer was used by everyone even before it was patented. Okay, Kathy, I know has to respond to that. That would have gone out public. No, okay. Google.
Nobody wanted it.
That's the thing.
Okay.
And they could, by the way, market hands on the key secrets. Nobody would pick it up. That's why he started something like 14 decades.
So one could still start a company. Right? You could still start a company, even if it wasn't marketed. People did use Google eventually, the technology. So even if it was open sourced, one could potentially still have a company out of it. Certainly Cohen-Vayer, there's no doubt about it. It was used prior to the patent. It was already generalized. So you have a whole set of technologies that go that way. Some things might not, proprietary molecules might not, but I know somebody reviewed a paper of mine and said, well, penicillin was, I don't think, patented, and Taxol wasn't patented, though someone made a lot of money off the process, I think Florida State. So you might want to say something about that also.
Bob,
yeah, Bob.
You have no idea.
Well, I know you were a reviewer, so not because they told me.
There you go. Bob, if I can interpret, so where a particular invention may be both rival in use and demanding of a lot of follow-on risk capital put forward to really drive it forward through commercialization, you're suggesting, well, maybe there, IP, not just throwing it out in the public domain is essential to that. Christina?
I think it's an interesting idea. I do think, though, that it seems to me you have to look at it in the global context. I've had patents that when I went to Japan and tried to license them to all the US companies, that the people sitting in the audience, and after I walked out, they filed patents on it. They couldn't explain it because I never told them the secret sauce of it. But, when you think about it in the context of the US, it's fine to throw it all out in open source. But this is a global, someone said an economic war. It's a global, let's say, a competitiveness. I think that one has to protect the IP to innovate and give the opportunity to create the jobs here.
Yeah, there's members of our Congress and some of the heads of our big research funding agencies, DOD, NIH, NSF, are very much in tune with keeping it in the U.S. And so that's a big issue, too, because they're funding most of the research.
We could argue about where inventions fall, how close to the inventor, where do they fall, do they actually spread like wildfire across borders like that? Is it easy, that easy, without the know-how that surrounds the invention to just copy it? So there is a discussion in the literature.
Let me ask Tony, though, on this subject, because you say, hey, we signed these non-exclusive deals. That's really what we're after, and Intel, IBM may be working off the same IP, and that's fine. Wouldn't those inventions, how well would it work for those inventions not to be at all protected by IP, just put in the public domain? How would that affect the movement to commercialization?
Well, I'm inclined to agree with Christina and Richard that actually you need some IP protection.
Even for those?
For the university patents, not for the Intel or the...
Well, in general, for business, that in order to get investments, you need to have some unique stuff that other people can't copy.
Very
right?
True.
So even for non-exclusively access?
So we have what we ask for is a non-exclusive license, and then we ask for the option to negotiate for an exclusive license.
I see.
And for which there would be an extra deal. And that's typical of, I think, what most of the IT companies now would.
So that preserves the option, even in the case of a non-exclusive, it preserves the option of moving
forward.
Although
I seem to remember we had some interesting dialogue with the University of California.
Okay.
We need to acknowledge that universities do a ton of open sourcing, right? It's not uncommon. It's something universities do and with great abandon, right? If you go on SourceForge, you're going to find that a lot. A lot of times what technology transfer offices are doing are looking at, with this particular piece of IP, is it more useful to attach an IP tag to it, or is it not useful to attach an IP tag to it? Right, and that is the technology transfer office's core job, is to help to think about the strategic dissemination of intellectual property.
This is in work with John, but in fact, to put this whole discussion in context, we've done some survey work published a few years ago. The main channel through which university research gets out and affects industrial R&D are not licenses. Okay, it is through publication, public meetings, conferences, informal information exchange, and then actually a part of that, again, not IP per se, this speaks to the issue of know-how, is consulting is terribly important as well. But that's just to put this discussion in a broader context, and whatever we do and whatever we want to do here, we don't want to undermine those vehicles, and those can be at risk. John Walsh had a point.
So there was some kind of slippery stuff that just happened here. I want to point out that yes, it is the case. So there's technologies, and you know, we know this from other work, right? There's technology that has not a key way of protecting the invention, but we know that, you know, small molecule drugs and similar things are one of the areas. The argument is that the companies won't commercialize unless they have some form of protection, and patents are often a good one. Given all of that, it does not follow that a university has to be patented. What's critical is there has to be some form of protection, and often patents are the form. But in the case of EPO and Amgen, we have a nice example of, you know, that's a drug company, and, you know, it's a original was published. Amgen, you know, makes a startup very successful, you know, on that. The University of Chicago's lesson from this was, you know, crying about the thing that got away, and this goes to something that was in Mark's paper. We could have a discussion about whether the university should have made more money off of that invention than before. But it's not the case that there was no patentable subject matter, that they weren't able to get exclusivity, that they weren't able to commercialize, even in the case where the original discovery was published and now readily available. So, you know, we can all agree that it's important for firms to have some way of capturing their investment without, I'm not actually going to make an argument that we should throw everything in the public domain, but I'm just saying that we need to think about how else you could capture that without necessarily assuming that it's the university that has to be licensed. Now, if you want the university to get the rents from it, which we might want, then, you know, Chicago's lesson is you made a picture of people on it.
Or Cambridge's on monoclonals.
I'd like to add that, you know, a lot of venture capitalists have discovered you can make good money on open source.
Right, sure. So I think Tony, then Christina.
Yeah, I would like to just bring up something about open source. Okay, so what I used to do as dean was spend time educating my faculty about the different types of open source licenses. Where there's a GPL type license, which actually essentially is designed to prevent a standard software company existing, right? And then there's a BSD, Berkeley style license, if you like, which is copy central as opposed to copy left, if you like, which allows you to do anything you like, start a company. So I had academics who've been publicly funded, and I come from that community. I used to do open source too under a BSD license. But if they've chosen the wrong license and then they want to commercialize it, then they're left with a support type model, which is very can't become the next MATLAB, the next Mathematica, the next Fluent or whatever software company you want. So I do think that there's a need for education of both the TTOs and of the faculty about, I used to say, choose whatever you like. If you religiously want to do GPL, that's fine by me. But you should know that it implies a business model as well, right? And the academics love open source. You say put everything up, okay. But the fact that in SourceForge, of the 150,000 odd projects there, you know, probably 98% of them have two developers and two users, right? I mean, that's just true. And it isn't suddenly magically that, you can have my code. It doesn't work on your machine, but you've got the code. You can fix it. Right? Well, that's not what most biologists, chemists, environmental scientists want to do. And so I do think there is a need for a proper debate. The reason why Linux and everything works, Marshall was telling me IBM have 8,000 professional software developers working paid on Linux, right? I mean, the ones that you know are not done by people free in their spare time. So let's be realistic about what open source is. It's a very good way for exploring. It gives you failure for free. You can actually, no, I'm serious. You can actually go and explore a huge thing in a way that companies can't afford to take those risks. And just one of those thousands of things is a successful thing. And then you can actually go and do something with it. But companies can't do that. But that's what open source is about. And so I worry about putting everything into the open domain. I'm happy with open source, but you should be aware of the myths.
Christina, you had a remark.
Just a comment, a 50,000-foot high comment. You know, I think it all comes down to the social contract, you know, for the greater good of who. If we're talking about Alzheimer's or cancer, do I really care what country invents it or who in the world? I mean, it's a global issue, clean water, the things that help the environment. Someone figures out, you know, now you migrate to, well, what about energy? Well, that's very interesting. When I've traveled to China, they're not interested, even though I'm from Hopkins and biomedical sciences, they're more interested, what are you doing in energy? And we'd like to have a relationship there, because they see that the power flows literally with the power or energy. So I think that when you think about the greater good, I think we need to protect the IP to commercialize it, because you have to get people interested in their return on investment. It's either going to be dollars from a company, or it's going to be a not-for-profit curing a disease or maybe, you know, doing clean tech, green tech. And so I think it really comes back to who is the customer, who is the greater good. And if it's DOD or NSF, that's, I guess, why Bible came into being. And if it's someone else, a company, then that's got a different sort of equation. But I'm concerned about when I drive to work in Baltimore that there are people on the street without jobs. You know, I'm concerned that there are kids in the world that aren't getting educated. And when it comes down to it, what I hope, maybe this is my provostial hat going on again, is that we figure out a way to make the technology transfer reinvest in our country, in our universities, because that's not happening from the state because they don't have the funds or necessary.
And universities are great places to create commons, right? So you look at how numbers of universities collect together to create commons around bioinformatics software, around Parkinson's disease, right, around all sorts of things. Universities can collect people with disparate interests and create pools of things that companies would be unable to do so in the same way. And universities have done that for a long time, and they'll continue to do that.
Great. All the way back, you've been quite patient. Name and affiliation, please.
I would be able to go out.
let me suggest that question be taken up by panelists for the next couple of days. They're very important. But we are at the end of our 10:15 tether. But with that, Tony, you had one last point. So.
But, yes, about the multidisciplinary. I mean, Microsoft is now trying to do things in education, healthcare, and environment, using its computer science technology to work with scientists in universities. Yeah, that's what I'm trying to do, and it's actually, you know, as altruistic as it gets. It's not to create a business. It's trying to solve some of these problems. The other last comment I would make is that I spent a long time, probably 10, 15 years in a university, trying to make multidisciplinary centers work in a university funding structure, and I think it's difficult. Incentives, tenure, all these sort of things make it difficult.
Very good.
And I hope a follow-up panel can cover things like litigation reform that could help tech transfer.
If they don't, you can raise the questions and put them on the spot.
Wes, I'd like to thank you and all the members of the panel. I think it's great.
Send me your comments.